It's a pleasure.
I take it that applause is for me actually showing up to a talk. So this talk, actually, it's a little bit different than the title. I thought it's really sort of two half-hour talks. The first half hour is a bit about how the part of mathematics that I work on, how it is sort of been influenced by some of Thurston's ideas and where they have led. And then the second part is going to be more about the instanton floor homology for trivalent graphs. So the place that I want to start this is with the observation that one of the big main features of low-dimensional topology is that it's hard to embed low-genus surfaces in three- and four-dimensional manifolds. Of course, in three-dimensional manifolds, it's in some sense rather obvious knots. Non-trivial knots don't bound disks, et cetera. In dimension four, that sort of became understood from work of Kerver and Milner, where they found an obstruction to embedding two spheres. The part of the story that Bill's work comes into is in the late 70s, he introduced the Thurston norm, which kind of organized the failure of the possibility of embedding low genus surfaces. So the Thurston norm of a homology class is the minimum minus the Euler characteristic of an embedded oriented surface that has no S2 components and represents the given homology class. The definition makes good sense for an irreducible three manifold. And he also proved that if that three manifold carries a taut foliation, so that's a foliation for which there's a closed curve that meets all the leaves, then the inequality holds. I think Eli Ashberg likes to call this the inequality and tells it the Euler characteristic of an embedded surface is bounded by the Euler class of the taut foliation evaluated on the surface, or keeping track of the signs, this is telling that the Thurston norm of a homology class is bounded below by the evaluation of the Euler class of a taut foliation on the surface, and it's one of Dave Gabay's early theorems that characterizes the Thurston norm, in fact. Also went on to led to the work on sutured manifolds, et cetera, and which is now fundamental in understanding three manifolds, contact structures, foliations, et cetera. The beginning part of the talk is going to emphasize the fact that the inequality has a four-dimensional generalization, which is called the adjunction inequality, and this is a story for four manifolds now, and what it tells you is that this is proved by Kronheimer and myself originally, and it tells you that if you have a four manifold, then you can find a certain distinguished set of cohomology classes, so you have this this inequality. I forgot the sign. There's a sign error there. I should have written it like this. And this is valid for surfaces that have, so again, S is supposed to be an embedded surface with now non-negative self-intersection number. And you notice that, of course, when your four-manifold is a three-manifold cross S1, and your surface really sits inside the three-manifold, then this is just exactly the inequality. S dot S is zero in this case. So one thing that's still kind of annoying, even many years after Peter and I proved that these such classes exist, is that they're still extremely mysterious. Somehow a taut foliation is something you can imagine, think about, get your hands on, whereas these cohomology classes that four manifolds carry are much more mysterious. They arise from understanding some of the, in any of the invariants of four manifolds, from Donaldson invariants, that was where we originally started, Cyberg-Witten invariants, or the Ashvest-Szabo-Haygarth-Floor homology invariants. So it'd be great, you more geometrically oriented folks, to find what's a geometric structure on a four manifold for which this inequality holds.
So that inequality is just true for each individual Ki.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the way the first part of the talk and the second part of the talk tie together is that the work that Peter and I did in the early 90s that gave us this inequality, we've revisited it, and it's now become the story that relates some instanton stuff to Havanov homology, and well, we'll see. Anyway, so this original stuff is, that's excellent. Just what I said. Great. Okay. Some recent theorems that we can prove is that Havanov homology in its reduced form detects the unknot, and we can also prove, so Jake Rasmussen has an invariant that comes out of Havanov homology, which is a lower bound for the slice genus of a knot. So remember, if I here's S3 bounding the four ball, and if I have a knot K, then the minimal a version of the minimal genus problem is I could look for surfaces inside the four ball that bound the knot. That's the four ball genus, and this S invariant is a combinatorially defined invariant defined by Jake. It comes out of the combinatorics of Havanov homology, and in Jake's story, he was able to prove that it gives you this bound for the four-ball genus. And using the fact that we could relate Havanov homology to gauge theoretic invariants, we could prove that, in fact, this bound persists if you allow yourself to imagine that instead of just the standard four-ball, this was just a homotopy four-ball. So this exactly the same bound holds. And that theorem is of some interest because there was some work of Friedman, Walker, Gompf, and Scott.
Morrison.
Yes. Thanks. Where they were hoping to use this S invariant actually to test if some potential constructions were counterexamples to the Poincaré conjecture, four-dimensional Poincaré conjecture. And by finding, hopefully, a knot where it bounded something of too small genus in the homotopy four ball. But the S invariant was the obstruction, the S invariant. Anyway, so that's not going to work. But, by the way, where's Ron? Hi, Ron. So, sometimes in order to make life interesting, you have to make bets. So Ron and I have now made a bet, which involves one of us paying for dinner for the other somewhere, involving the Poincaré conjecture. So four-dimensional smooth Poincaré conjecture. So I'm betting that more or less within the next 10 years it'll be solved, and Ron's betting against. So anyway.
Neither is betting on how it's going to go.
What?
Neither is betting on how it's going to go.
No, I'm betting that it will be proved in the next 10 years.
Proved.
Yeah. And Ron, right? That's right. And Ron is betting that nothing will happen in the next 10 years. Okay, not for any good reason, but we'd like it, dinner is a good bet. Nobody loses. Okay, so I want to explain a little bit of the mathematics around where the four-dimensional version of the inequality comes up. This is the story of the Donaldson invariance. We're going to do this in a little more generality. Anyway, so the Donaldson invariants are invariants that come from studying anti-self-dual connections in a principal bundle, principal SUN bundle, or more generally, a PUN bundle on a four-manifold. And we look at this moduli space of anti-self-dual connections. That's a subset of the space of A is the space of connections in the bundle. G is the gauge group. This is a sort of distinguished submanifold depending on the metric inside the space. The space of connections mod gauge is pretty close to this mapping space, the space of maps from X to the classifying space of BSUN, pulling back the bundle, the component that pulls back the bundle P. So this is in this form, it's quite standard to understand its algebraic topology, at least rationally. And after a lot of work, what you can prove is that there's sort of a well-defined integration map over this cycle, and it divides on a linear function on the cohomology of this mapping space. Okay, and by the way, to understand this cohomology, the standard trick is to look at the evaluation map, and then what you can show is that the cohomology, say with Q coefficients, is generated as a ring by the Kunneth components of the pullbacks of the churn classes under the evaluation map. And a nice way to provide some notation for that, each of the churn classes gives you a map from the homology of your manifold to the cohomology of this mapping space by pulling back the churn class and then slanting against the homology class. It behaves on degrees as indicated. And in the case of SU2 bundles, what you find is that if you sum over all SU2 bundles, the evaluation on, this side is sort of a formal expression at the moment. If you take the exponential of mu map of a two-dimensional homology class, that gives you a two-dimensional cohomology class. Now I take its exponential, which is an infinite sum in the symmetric algebra, and I evaluate it on all moduli spaces, and there's some extra little factor here, then this turns out to be remarkably simple. It's just a function of the self-intersection number of the surface, and then there's some distinguished cohomology classes. Oops, there's some coefficients missing there. So it's just a sum of exponentials of evaluations of these distinguished cohomology classes. These are the ones that come up in the adjunction inequality. This nice formula holds when the four-manifold has what's called simple type. So simple type means that this Donaldson map, this map, it annihilates the ideal generated by what happens when you, if you take a point on the manifold, a zero-dimensional homology class, you get a four-dimensional cohomology class. You square it, and then so this particular, if you look at any element of the cohomology that's a multiple of this class, if it's killed, then the manifold has simple type. All the four manifolds that we know have simple type. For example, symplectic manifolds always have simple type. It's very easy to check if four manifolds have simple type. We still don't know if all four manifolds have simple type. And Ron and I have another bet. We drank a little bit too much last night. In fact, this one has money for the solver involved. My inclination is that all manifolds have simple type, and Ron's is not. So if somebody proves finds a counterexample, a four-manifold that doesn't have simple type, or proves that they all do, then one of us will give you some money.
Is so, this sum on the left finite or infinite?
This is an infinite sum.
So in particular, you have convergence of that series.
Yeah, we don't have, well, yeah, so that's right. This thing converges, that's correct. That's part of the content of the theorem.
Is that saying that those mu2 of s's are getting very negative or something?
No, this side is, well, I mean, this is a, so just to be, so the, each of these moduli spaces is finite dimensional. So when you evaluate each of them, you get a number, and then it's the fact that, but there are infinitely many of these guys. And, you know, anyway. I mean, there's a convergence issue, but this is, you know, this side, they're not getting, there's an exponential, right? So there's a factorial that's killing off growth, right? I mean, so these things, if it's saying something about how quickly they grow. It's not saying that it goes to zero, right?
Is this an equality between numbers?
It's an equality between numbers, yes.
So the series on the left does converge?
Yes.
What makes it converge?
Magic.
Why do the terms get small?
Well, there are factorials in here. One, you know, reciprocals are factorials in the definition of the exponential. So it's, you know, it's saying, anyway, you know, if I look at this evaluation, right, it's just saying that this, as k gets big, so you have to evaluate these guys on different moduli spaces, but if k gets big, these just don't grow so fast because you have to divide them by k factorial in the sum, right? I mean, just like e to the 10, that makes sense, right?
That's a big number.
Yeah, it's a big number. That's okay. There's a big number over here, too. Anyway, so what do I want to say? Yeah, so there's the Donaldson invariance. Then there's instanton floor homology. So instanton floor homology or cohomology is the Morse homology or cohomology of the Chern-Simons function on a space of connections on a PUN bundle over a three-manifold. In the case that the bundle is trivialized, this is the definition of the Chern-Simons function. And the beautiful fact about the Chern-Simons function in dimension three is that its first variation has a very nice, simple expression. The space of connections is an affine space. Right, and if I pick a connection and then I move and I move out along a line through a connection move out along this line here, and then watch how the Chern-Simons function changes. Its infinitesimal change is the integral over y of pairing of the curvature of the base point with the tangent vector that you're moving along in. And in particular, this is telling you that the critical points of the Chern-Simons function are the flat connections. And so the gauge equivalence classes of critical points are, well, gauge equivalence classes of flat connections. Gauge equivalence classes of flat connections are, you can identify with representations of the fundamental group up to conjugacy. So this floor homology is sensitive to the existence of representations of the fundamental group. And furthermore, you can, so playing along with this formal analogy with the finite dimensional story, if you pick a Riemannian metric on Y, then you can think of the space of connections as becoming a Riemannian manifold using this defining the inner product to just be the L2 inner product on the algebra valued 1 forms. And then the downward gradient flow for Chern-Simons becomes this PDE. And this PDE, if I think of this A as, so a solution would be a one parameter family of connections. And if I think of that as a connection on the form manifold R times Y, then this is equivalent to the anti-self-dual Yang-Mills equations. So that's it's the analysis of the anti-self-dual and Yang-Mills equations, thanks to Uhlenbeck, Taubes, Donaldson, et cetera, that allows you to construct the Morse complex. But in any case, there is a Morse complex. You have to be careful, as I'll explain later. It's not defined for any three manifold, and it's not defined for all three manifolds and all principal bundles. There's a restriction that you need to keep in mind. But when it works, this is what it is, and it's an invariant of the three manifold and the principal bundle on it. This floor homology is related to the Donaldson invariants in that it's the right thing when you try and try and take the topological quantum field theory point of view. In fact, this is one of the original motivations for simply formulating the notion of a topological quantum field theory. That is to say, when you have a four-manifold with boundary and a principal bundle on this four-manifold that restricts to the given one on its boundary, then you can extend this map that we had before. So for a closed manifold, integration over the moduli space gave you a map to the real numbers. Here it gives you a map to the instanton floor homology instead. Tautologically, if you look at the Morse homology construction, when you change the orientation of the three manifold, that changes the sign of the Chern-Simons function. So it changes homology to cohomology and vice versa. You can often prove is that if you have a closed four manifold and it's decomposed along a suitable three manifold, you can often obtain the invariance of the closed manifold by a Kronecker pairing between homology and cohomology for the relative invariance. An instance of this map, if we take our four manifold to be just three an interval times the three manifold, then we can think of the map that we had before. Remember that cohomology of the configuration space that is generated by a map from the homology of the manifold to the configuration space, and then cohomology of the configuration space, that's this mu 2, the second Chern class, and that gives you, so then you would get a map from the homology of the three manifold to the endomorphisms of the instanton floor homology, right? So in the case that X is an interval times Y, in general, if you have a manifold with boundary, you get a map from, simplifying slightly what I said before, you get a map from the two-dimensional homology of this manifold into endomorphisms of floor homology. So in this case, for the, this particular case, we get a map of this sort. And the, in fact, these guys are acting by commuting endomorphisms. And what you can show further is that actually the spectrum, if I represent geometrically my two-dimensional homology class by an oriented surface, then the spectrum of the resulting operator on the floor homology, its eigenvalues are even integers that lie between the Euler characteristic and minus the Euler characteristic of the surface. And in this way, you actually can recover the Thurston norm. So in the fact that the Thurston norm is determined by knowing the spectra of these operators. And in particular, if you're careful about when floor homology is defined, then one thing that this story eventually proves is that if you have a three manifold with B1 positive, it's irreducible, then there exists a representation of the fundamental group of a three manifold into SO3, which doesn't lift to SU2. In particular, it's a non-trivial, it's an interesting representation. And I think, you know, I think it's a nice conjecture, which maybe is one that there's more hope for proving, that actually, with the exception of of the three sphere, every three manifold admits a non-trivial representation into SU2. So this, at least, you know, now, thanks to all the great new work, at least hyperbolic manifolds up to finite covers do so. So, okay. Now, Thurston comes back into, just doesn't get away from our story. So I told you the story about how Donaldson invariance in floor homology, just for ordinary four manifolds and three manifolds, it turns out to be useful, as Thurston taught us, to think about orbifolds. I mean, generalize the story to the context of orbifolds. So what we're going to do this in the sort of simplest possible way, first starting off with a four manifold. So we want a four manifold containing a surface, so just an ordinary smooth four manifold containing a smoothly embedded surface, but we're going to reinterpret that data as defining for us an orbifold. And it's an orbifold that just has cone angle pi along that surface. Okay? So the simplest possible thing, by requiring the cone angle to be pi, there's not really any extra choice in the orbifold structure. And what we're going to do is do gauge theory on these orbifold SUN bundles. The interesting extra bit of data that you get when you when you're thinking about the bundle is that above this orbifold locus, above this surface, in order to construct the orbifold structure on the bundle, you need an endomorphism of order 2 Z2 action on the lift of the bundle, which is going to be non-trivial along this, that should be along the surface. And in fact, well, you know, although it took Peter and I a long time to do this, once you've, you know, swallowed the orbifold pill, then there's no particular reason to require the singular locus to be a smooth manifold. It's useful to generalize, to allow S not just to be a smooth submanifold, but to be a kind of singular surface, which has become, you know, in the sort of physics literature and not invariant literature is called a foam. We'll come back to that later. Anyway, so we're just going to look at these simple simple kind of orbifolds. And then we can, as with most analysis, once you decide to work on orbifolds, the only thing that's complicated is just keeping track of what an orbifold means. But the analysis itself is just, you just repeat all the analysis that you did and just make it invariant under some group action. So there's not much extra work to work in this context. But now, the interesting thing that happens here is that the floor homology, what does it look at? Well, it's now representations of the orbifold fundamental group, but a little bit more concretely, it's representations of the knot complement, but where meridians of the knot in this story will go to some element of order 2. So they're not representations naturally of the whole fundamental group, but they have they're slightly damaged along the knot. The polynomial is an element of order 2. So I want to think about this in the simplest possible example first. Let's look at representations of the fundamental group of a knot in the three-sphere complement into SU2, and where the meridians go to the two-sphere of elements inside SU2, whose square is -1. So remember, so I'm doing a couple of things which I hope are not too confusing at the same time. For the Z2 orbifold business, we want to look at PUN bundles, so PU2 bundles in this case. So PU2 is SO3. Right? We need something of order 2 in PU2. Now, I can think of that a little more concretely as looking at it as a map to SU2, but rather than rather than it squaring to 1, an element of order 2, it's something that's whose square is in the center of SU2. Now there are two choices, whether or not it's plus or minus 1. Minus 1 is the interesting one, so that's what we're going to look at. So just to so we're looking at conjugates of this matrix inside SU2. That's a two-sphere inside SU2. If you think of SU2 as the three-sphere, that's the equator where plus and minus 1 are the north pole and south pole of the three-sphere. Now, what is the space of representations that we get? Well, for the unknot, of course, it's the two-sphere. Here we're looking at not representations up to conjugacy, just representations. For the unknot, we get the two-sphere, or if you have a unknot of unlink of k components, then you just get a product of two spheres. That's easy. A little more interestingly, if you look at the trefoil, then the representation space has two components. There's a component, which is a two-sphere, which is just factoring through the map from the fundamental group of the complement to the homology of the complement, just reproducing this guy really. And then there's another component of the space of representations, which is a SO3 or RP3. And what's interesting about these two examples is that the homology of these representation spaces actually reproduce the Hovanov homology. So the Hovanov homology, as I am evidently assuming you all know, is some combinatorial invariant of knots. It's quite a pretty and interesting story. But if you compute it, then for the unknot of k components, it's just z2 z squared tensored together k times. And for the trefoil, it's the Hovanov homology is four copies of z and a z2. So it's interesting that even there's torsion there, and this picture sees that torsion. Now, just as an aside, it's kind of fun to think about what these representation spaces look like, and there's a pretty picture to try and get to know them, which is, you know, I mean, in general, it's hard to compute what representation spaces look like, but there's a little trick that sometimes helps you here. So here's the, you know, for not complement, we have the usual Vertinger presentation. So here's the blue guys are the two arcs of the knot crossing each other. This guy is going over this guy, and then there are generators of the fundamental group that is xi, xj, and xk, which come from taking some base point out at that out there, and then running it curved to here and back, and then of course you get this relation. Now, the neat little fact here is that conjugating. So you know, now we're looking at a representation where all the meridians. These are all, of course, these are all meridians of the knot. These x's, so they all land on this two-sphere in this SU2 case, and what you find is that this relation, when you combine it with the fact that these guys are landing on this two-sphere, conjugating by xi when xi is in the two-sphere is actually the geodesic reflection. You know, rho of xi is a point on the two-sphere, and two-sphere is a symmetric space. As a map which has that as its unique fixed point and acts by minus 1 on the tangent space. And conjugating by rho of xi acts by that symmetric space involution. And so what you see is that whenever you have one of these Vertinger words, Vertinger relations, then what that's telling is that the guy that's conjugating is the midpoint along the geodesic between the other two points. And that, so if you look at, so it's easy, once you know that, it's easy to figure out what the representation for the space for the trefoil is, for example. Of course, in general, it's impossible, but this helps you in some examples. Anyway, so we can extend this game to SUN. And we can consider elements in SUN. Again, you know, we're really doing PUN, but we're going to think of them by lifting them up to SUN and requiring that their square is some central element of SUN. So this is the picture. But now in the SUN case, then well, this automorphism has two eigenvalues, and so that now there are more conjugacy classes than in the SU2 case, depending on the dimension of, say, this eigenspace. We pick one of the square roots of that guy and as our favorite, and then there are different conjugacy classes according to the dimension of that eigenspace. So let's suppose it's fixed. It's some k-dimensional. That eigenspace is k-dimensional. So these guys now, generalizing the previous story, form a copy of a Grassmannian sitting inside SUN. So that conjugacy class is a Grassmannian inside SUN. And we're going to make things simple. Look at the case of k equals 1. So that means there's one eigenvalue, one-dimensional eigenspace with this eigenvalue, and n minus 1 eigenspace with the opposite sign. That's the CPn minus 1 case. And in that case, what you find is that for the what's the representation space then for the k equals 1 case? It's just copies of CPn minus 1. I mean, for the unknot, it's CPn minus 1. That's the only, I'm just telling you that that generator lands somewhere on CPn minus 1. Or it's a product of CPn minus 1s for unknot of k components. And if you look at the symmetric space game, having said symmetric space, These are all symmetric spaces, and that symmetric space game for computing things keeps going. And now what you find is that, say, for the trefoil, the representation variety is a copy of CPN minus 1 and a copy of the unit tangent bundle of CPN minus 1, generalizing the case of the two-sphere CP1 and the unit tangent bundle of the two-sphere RP3, in the case that n equals 2. And again, these guys now reproduce the Havanov-Rozansky homology of these examples. And again, that's kind of, this guy has some torsion in its homology, which is the same as the torsion in the homology of Havanov-Rozansky. So there's a pretty, you know, smells like there's a pretty story there. Now, I have to try and be a little bit clearer about when these floor homology groups make sense. So I was kind of brushing under the rug some technicalities, and now we have to pick up the rug a little bit and try and be a little bit more honest. So first of all, we're dealing with PUN bundles, so there's an extra characteristic class. There's a picture. We're dealing with PUN bundles, so there's a characteristic class. They're still orbifold bundles, so the bundle is only defined on the complement of the surface. So here, this is the four-dimensional line. Okay, so there's a characteristic class W in H2 of X minus S with Zn coefficients, and we're going to keep track of that guy. I forgot the first sentence here. We're looking at PUN connections, and in general, PUN connections can have kind of more complicated stabilizers than SUN connections. And there's a trick to avoid that, which is to look at PUN connections modulo gauge transformations that lift to SUN. Then the story becomes simpler. So if you have an SUN connection, its stabilizers always just subgroup that leaves invariant some block decomposition of CN. But if you have PUN, then the stabilizer can become something more complicated. And so, there's this little technical trick of only using gauge transformations that lift to SUN. That makes it a little bit harder to keep track of things functorially when you try and define maps and floor homology. So that's dealt with by, these PUN bundles have this characteristic class, and we're going to keep track of that characteristic class. So here's this pair, four manifold with surface. There's this bundle defined on the complement of this guy with some characteristic class, and we're going to keep track of a geometric representative of it. So that's what this blue stuff is. It's a surface, an auxiliary surface inside the four manifold, which is keeping track of W2. That surface can have boundary on the S that we have. So just, anyway, to try and be honest. Sometimes a surface could be non-orientable. Over here, here's how we're going to think about the critical points of Chern-Simons. Again, mod gauge, where this means SUN, gauge transformations that lift SUN. They're conjugacy classes of representations of the fundamental group now of what? Well, in the three-manifold case, there's still, we're doing this orbifold business along the knot K, but we have this PUN bundle, so there's this extra characteristic class which is represented, for which we pick a representative, which is this blue curve in this picture. Okay, and now what we're going to look at is the critical points of Chern-Simons correspond to representations of the fundamental group of actually the complement of both the knot and this representative of the characteristic class W. But now they have the property that if, sorry, that should be omega. So there's W, the cohomology class, and there's omega, it's a representative of it. And what we want is that the if you take the holonomy of the connection around W for a curve that links it once, it's some central element of SUN. And if it's inside this, it's inside this Grassmannian, if the loop links the knot once. Okay? So this first condition, if I pass to a PUN bundle rather than an SUN bundle, it means the bundle extends, but it'll extend as a non-trivial bundle. Okay, anyway, that's a little bit technical, but just so nobody gives me counterexamples to what I say, I feel I need to say it. Again, like I said before, an orbifold bundle doesn't necessarily give you a bundle on the four manifold, it only gives you a bundle on the complement. Anyway, so you can do, actually this isn't really important for this talk. Anyway, but this is, so I'm not gonna say it. Anyway, never mind that. okay, so the problem when you're trying to define instanton floor homology is the fact that the quotient space connections mod gauge, this isn't usually a manifold. It's not a manifold because this doesn't act freely. And we're trying to do the Morse homology really on the quotient space. Now it turns out it's not actually so important for the Morse homology to work that the quotient space isn't a manifold. What's really more important is that none of the critical points lie in the singular set. None of the critical points have non-trivial stabilizer. So we want to put ourselves in a position where we can avoid reducible representations of the fundamental group. And there's a simple trick to avoid that. So if you look at the just the two torus, there it is, then, well, of course, if I look at the representation space of representations into SUN of the fundamental group of the torus, that's just a pair of commuting matrices, that's a complicated gadget, or a pair of commuting matrices up to conjugacy. That's a complicated gadget. However, if I look at representations where, not that, to the, how do I say it? I look at representations where the representations of the kind that we're looking at, representations into PUN, where the bundle that carries them is non-trivial. As long as the bundle's non-trivial, it turns out that there's a unique up to conjugacy representation. It's easy to write it down, anyway. Now, so that said, well, if I look at the Hopf link H, and I give myself omega, a curve joining the two components, well then, of course, the complement of the Hopf link is retracts onto a two torus, and this curve hits the two torus once. So what I can do to make sure things work is I can just I start off with my knot in my three manifold, and I prescribe a little bit of extra data so I can canonically stick in a Hopf link. So this extra bit of data it's really a plane in the tangent space plus a vector in that plane, but at some point. Anyway, then I can canonically stick in a Hopf link, and make sure that my bundle is on that hop link is the one that has only irreducible representations. Now, then for this gadget, the instanton floor homology is always well defined. So you can canonically get a knot invariant in this way, so we kind of call this construction on the level of the knot. We're going from k to k, k natural, and then define this version of the instanton floor homology to be the ordinary instanton floor homology of this knot with the hop link added to it. Now, the nice thing that this does, so remember the critical points of Chern-Simons are actually they're conjugacy classes of representations. And that beautiful story that I was telling you relating to Havanov homology, I was insisting that we were looking at not conjugacy classes of representations, but just representations, period. And adding this hop link actually fixes that story. The representation on the hop link is a, when I restrict to the neighborhood of the hop link, there's a unique irreducible representation. So the space of representations, the way the representation space of this guy is related to the representation space of this guy is that actually representations not up to conjugacy of this three manifold correspond to representations up to conjugacy of this three manifold and not. So we sort of, by doing this trick, we've put ourselves in a good position. Now, as I mentioned before, the ordinary instanton floor homology, the ordinary instanton floor homology, it's functorial under cobordisms. There's a map from, now I've generalized it from the way I've said it, but if a four manifold with two boundary components, then I can think of, integration over the moduli space on this manifold gives you a map between the two, between the floor homologies, and that story persists to this story, where now we have a story about cobordism of pairs. We have start off with a three manifold with a knot in it. There's this extra data keeping track of the bundle. That's the omega. And then if we have a cobordism to another three manifold with knot and bundle data, as long as that cobordism has to keep track of the, be compatible with the bundle data, then we get a map. Okay, so what can we do with that map? Well, we're studying knots. It's natural to consider the Skein exact sequence and see, Skein knots that are related by a Skein relation. So we have, imagine three knots, say, in the three sphere, which differ only inside a three ball in the usual way, like this. There's another picture of these three guys, which show you that this has a natural kind of Z3 symmetry. If I think of these guys as running along the opposite edges of a tetrahedron, there are three different ways, only three different ways to put them in. Right? So we get three different knots in a natural way. And these knots are coordinate between natural surfaces, but using natural surfaces, which are, there's this sort of twisted rectangle which is sitting inside the, that's the rectangle that goes between these guys, K2 and K1. So it sits inside this tetrahedron. And then I can put it into the tetrahedron times I by thinking of it so that these vertices become just intervals, this picture over here is the level sets of a function that I'm going to use on this twisted rectangle to stick it into S3 times I. Right, so I want these two edges to be at the zero end of S3 times I, these two edges to be at the one end of S3 times I, and then, well, this function interpolates between them. Of course, it's not a function at these vertices, but those vertices just get stretched out. So there's a natural cobordism between these guys. And so now that there's a little tricky point that I didn't emphasize yet. These cobordisms typically that we're constructing typically are not in general orientable. Whenever if K2 and K1 are both have the same number of components, then that cobordism is necessarily a Möbius band, and it's not orientable. And you need to be very careful when you have non-orientable surfaces, because if I'm thinking about the holonomy around that surface, it matters which way I go typically. I mean, whether I'm going, in a positive sense or a negative sense. In the case where n equals 2, this matrix in SU2 is conjugate to this matrix, right? So the holonomy going around one way is conjugate to the holonomy going around the other way. That eventually allows you to define maps for non-orientable surfaces in the case that n equals 2, or more generally, if n is an even number and k is half that number, then there's still a map for non-orientable surfaces. For n equals 2, these cobordisms actually do induce maps. So we get this trio of floor homologies and trio of maps. And in fact, this is an exact triangle. So just as Hovanov homology satisfies a skein relation, there's an exact sequence, exact triangle. The same thing's true for our instanton floor homology. And the proof that this is an exact triangle is relatively straightforward. Just trying to understand by just understanding the topology of the composite cobordisms, which is completely elementary, and then the interesting technical part of it is using those composite cobordisms to construct suitable chain maps between the mapping cone of one of these maps and the third opposite the complex for the opposite vertex. So eventually iterating the skein exact sequence is what leads to the spectral sequence that computes this instanton not invariant in whose E1 page turns out to be the Hovanov complex. And that spectral sequence is what's used to prove the theorems I mentioned earlier. Now, just go on for a moment. For n bigger than 2, you need to extend this story in an interesting way, because actually the definition of Hovanov-Rosansky is much harder than the definition of Hovanov homology. It doesn't, Hovanov homology somehow, if you just work in the world of knots, you can define it. For Hovanov-Rosansky homology, you need to at least work with knotted trivalent graphs, and the story there's algebraically much more complicated using the notion of matrix factorizations, et cetera. And maybe I'll just end up with this guy. Actually, I'll end up with this one. Yes. So, we've already committed ourselves to using orbifolds. So why not use orbifolds where the singular locus is no longer a knot, but we could imagine a trivalent graph, for example, as being the singular locus, where the orbifold group at that point is Z2 times Z2. Okay? If we do that, then the analogous story you know, we can still do the analogous story, but now there's an interesting relation. Namely, if I look at the holonomy of the connection around this guy and around this guy, it has to multiply to the holonomy around this guy. So, for example, if these guys both have one-dimensional eigenspaces, k equals one story here, then this guy will have to have k equals two. And so you can now extend the story to these knotted trivalent graphs where they're labeled by, each leg is labeled by a vertex with a kind of conservation law at each of the vertices. And you can check that for very simple trivalent graphs like this guy, that the representation space in this sense, you can check this is a two-step flag manifold, its homology agrees with Hovanov-Rosansky. And actually, this also gets rid of the need for, it gets rid of the orientation problem. So anyway, you can still prove in the case that when you're only dealing with ones and twos, that this sequence leads to a skein leads to so now there's the instanton floor homology of this guy is well defined, and these three knots or trivalent graphs fit into a exact sequence. And anyway, that's sort of where we are, and we're hoping that eventually we'll be able to relate this instanton floor homology for trivalent graphs actually to the Hovanov-Rosansky story. That's still quite unknown. But anyway, okay, I'll stop there. It wasn't true for just the instanton floor homologies. For simple knots, they turn out to be the same, but like sort of, I think 3-4 torus knot, for example, I think it's the smallest example where the instanton floor homology group has smaller rank than Hovanov homology. So